Hey, man. How's it going?
That's good.
Me too. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show.
I think I need to send a text message here so that a text message will get sent.
All right. Yeah, it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. That's also the name of my website, Scott Horton. .org, that is. ScottHorton.org. I'm not really an org so much as a human individual, but some other guy's got .com, so what are you going to do? I know.
You don't even have anything there.
I asked him if I could have it. He said no. Anyway, ScottHorton.org. You can find all my stuff there. You know what also you can find there? The chat room. That's not just my stuff. That's yours, too. Join up the chat room. Especially if, you know, you got Friday off. And usually you can't at work, but now that you're listening at home, in fact, you can join up the chat room, unlike usual. You know who you are. Join up the chat room. ScottHorton.org/chat. It's an IRC free node chat, hashtag Scott Horton Show, but it's also just plain old URL. Plain old browser window page. ScottHorton.org/chat. Fake name and a captcha, and you're in there. Questions, comments, accusations, footnotes for when I can't remember. You know, whatever. El Camino discussions.
What's the date? I want to write it on my page, you know, for posterity.
All right. So we got lots of news. And, hey, guess what? No. Dar Jamail is going to be on the show today. All right. Good old Dar Jamail, man. I like that dude. He does some good reporting. And this here reporting is about the military destroying as much of the last vestiges of American wilderness that they can get their bombs around. They're really bad people. So anyway, so Dar Jamail, he's on the environmentalist beat. Trying to avoid the wars for now, I think. And yet, here the war comes to his environmentalist beat. So, of course, they're the greatest polluters on the planet. Destroying what remains. How the U.S. Navy plans to war game the Arctic. Writing from Alaska, where he's from. Dar Jamail. So that's coming up on the show. I'm not telling you when, though, because then it'll be like a cliffhanger, suspenseful surprise, and maybe you'll want to hear him talk so bad that you'll stay tuned and listen to me. Yeah, I went to college to learn that. Nah, I didn't really go to college. I didn't really learn that. All right, man. Lots of news. Almost don't know where to begin. You know what? No Aronson today. What a shame. Well, that's where I'm going to start anyway, is his story, because we'll just do a short little police state section here to start the show before the first break. Our friend Trevor Aronson, he's a writer for Mother Jones, and he wrote the book that I wish I'd written. You know, Phil Giraldi and I, we had a whole book proposal and an outline and a sample chapter and all this stuff, man, the whole gig. And we were going to write a book about all the bogus terrorism prosecutions, the fake domestic war on terrorism to go along with the fake overseas one. And they all told us to go to hell. The publisher type people, they said, nobody cares about that. No one wants to read about that. That's maybe an academic work, but not a, you know, you can't sell that. Well, anyway, so Trevor Aronson wrote it. So I'm jealous, but I don't care because he's awesome and he did a better job than I could have done anyway, probably. I don't know about Phil. He's a pretty damn talented writer and a smart guy with a lot of access. But anyway, Aronson, he wrote the book on it, and it's called
the Terror Factory. And of course, he's referring to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Yeah, they're the guys who make up all the phony terror plots so they can orange alert and scare your mom and get away with bombing Yemen or whoever they want to bomb. And that's how they do it. But now check this out. I think this is real cool. And in fact, I'm glad I can't do the show today because I didn't get a chance to read this whole article yet. Only part of it. And the thing of it is, I love the headline though. I read the last paragraph. That's what I did. I cheated. I went ahead to the last paragraph and I read it. So the article is at The Intercept. Apparently, I was wrong just now when I said Mother Jones. Apparently, Trevor Aronson is now writing for Greenwald and them. And this piece is called Double Agent. How an FBI informant makes a new career as a defense expert. And so here's this guy. His job was setting people up in these bogus FBI stings. And apparently, it's just a numbers game, right? It's just a matter of time. The FBI uses rats to infiltrate and entrap people. Because oftentimes, they just infiltrate people. Like, not even an organization, but just become somebody's best friend in the world. Infiltrate his life. And then entrap him. If you do that enough, then it's just law of numbers. Eventually, one of them will become a paid defense expert who will go around. And this is how the article ends here. I'm going to spoil it for you. For the former FBI informant, this case is just the beginning of what he expects to be a new career. Now, every time a new FBI sting case is announced, Montiel calls the defense lawyers to offer his expertise. He's in talks now to join a new case, he says. I'm the only one out here who can do this. I think defense lawyers need me to give their... I don't know how to read. I'm the only one out here who can do this, he said. I think defense lawyers need me to give their client a fighting chance. So isn't that hilarious? Isn't that great? I sure hope that the defense lawyers take this guy up on it. And I sure hope that he can get up there and get some acquittals and shut down this bogus FBI program of entrapping idiots. They're always, you know, I guarantee you the smartest person they ever entrapped, his IQ was 100. The rest of these people, they deliberately are preying on people who are stupid and ignorant, and oftentimes mentally ill, severely suggestible, impressionable, or under severe financial strain, like they have immediate family members in a state of health crisis. And then the feds come and say, here's some money. Say you love Osama. Say you love Osama. Fine, I love Osama. Oh my God, look everybody, orange alert! Orange alert! You are gonna die except we saved you! The FBI cries. They're such liars. Give me a break. Are people really believing that still after all this time? After Miami? After three in New York? The New Jersey Fort Dix pizza plot? The Lodi, California, Hamid Hayat, and his father entrapped and set up by the FBI. The remote control plane attack on the Pentagon, the Portland Christmas tree lighting, the guy in Round Rock, Texas, who supposedly was recruited to go join ISIS. Come on. Who's buying this still? Well, FBI took the money out of your paycheck, and then they paid sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars to a rat to trick someone into saying that they would commit an act of violence. And we prosecute them and put them in prison for decades and call it terrorism and pretend that we got Al-Qaeda running around the United States. Which, if we do, you can guarantee the FBI's missing it like the Boston attackers because they're busy entrapping some idiot instead. Even though they knew the Boston attackers. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation.
And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
Hell yes, I'm drinking Darren's coffee out of my Roberts & Roberts hanging banker's mug. Oops. All right. So, yeah, it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I told you Dar Jamail is coming on the show, but guess what also is going to happen? Brad R. Hoff is coming back on the show. You might remember Brad. He was on for the first time just a few weeks ago. He's writing at a site now called Levant Report. And, he had written the article all about what Syria was like before America's Mujahideen were there. And so we talked with him about that, the destruction of Syria. And now you may have seen this report. It's at levantreport.com. Reprinted a couple other places, I believe. And it says, 2012 Defense Intelligence Agency document. West will facilitate rise of Islamic State in order to isolate the Syrian regime. That's the headline. And so, you know, I mentioned this briefly. I hadn't even read it yet. I had only seen the Fox headline about the damn thing at the time. I mentioned it on the Jeff Tucker show the other night, Eye on the Empire at liberty.me. And, but anyway, so yeah, man. So it has a whole bunch of stuff in here. But I will make a long story very short and save the rest for the Hoff interview. But just so you know, basically what it says here is we and our allies are on the side of the rebellion. The rebellion is Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And they have a pretty big constituency in Syria, too. Their movement during the whole Iraq War II straddled the border all along. And there is a possibility that they will create a Salafist principality in eastern Syria. And they'll break off, create an emirate there, basically. And that this is what the countries, the external powers supporting the opposition want to happen. And they seemingly include us in that they. And they even call it a Sunni, quote, Islamic State. And they warn, and they call it a warning, that the effect that this could have on Iraq... Did I mention this from 2012? I did. The effect that this could have on Iraq is that Ramadi and Mosul and other former favored pockets, they call them, hangouts of Al-Qaeda in Iraq could come back under their dominance. So not only are we creating a Salafist principality, not necessarily the Islamic State, but an Islamic State in eastern Syria, we're doing so knowing that the risk is that we're going to break Iraq and that Iraqi Sunnistan is going to fall under the control of these guys. And so... You know, I mean, what the hell? It's 2012. They'd already been embarking on the policy for almost a year, or maybe more than a year by then. Well, what date is it? That's certainly what we've been saying on this show all along, from 2011 on, right? There's that thing in The Guardian said, Bandar is shipping Mujahideen. That came out in, I think, April or May of 2011. Eric Margulies,
no later than August, I think probably July, June or July 2011, said, hey, I'm just back from France where all my asset contacts are telling me that French special forces are on the ground in Syria right now helping to organize and arm and fund the opposition there. That was 2011. NATO and Saudi working together on this thing. So, it's not like we didn't all know all along or anything like that. But here's somebody at DIA predicting the worst. And yet, they persisted. And now, but then here's the real rub. They continue to persist. In Western Islamic State, formerly known as Eastern Syria, America and its allies are still on the side of the Mujahideen. A year after the declaration of the caliphate. Almost a year. 11 months. Since the declaration of the caliphate. They're still on the Israeli-Saudi-Turkish program of regime change in Syria. And American neocon, but that's, I'm repeating myself. I already said Israel. And, I don't know. It's almost like maybe the SSRI lobby is in on this or something too, because they see profit in another huge war. I don't know. I'm just making that part up. But, so listen, I mean, all this stuff sounds like hyperbole. It sounds like a bunch of crap, right? Turkish officials take credit for Al-Qaeda gains in northwest Syria. They say pact with Saudis aimed at accelerating Assad's ouster. And there's nothing secret about it. They're bragging about it. It's the Associated Press, for Christ's sake. Right? I know. Isn't it funny? I do. This is my weird disorder thing that I have that makes me this way. Is that even though I've been saying this the whole time for 4 years straight, I'm still completely just shocked and flabbergasted. I can't get desensitized to the fact that what we're talking about is high treason. And I don't mean, in a Lysander Spooner sense, we're like, hey, I don't owe you any allegiance in the first place, so how could fighting you possibly be treason, jerk? I'm for that, but I'm talking about American public officials who are sworn to the U.S. Constitution. And they've been providing aid and comfort to the enemy. This whole freaking time. And they're perfectly happy to admit it, and I think it's quite apparent. Correct me if you guys are reading this a different way, but it sure seems to me like they're not doing the slightest thing to try to even encourage the Saudis and the Turks to, for that matter, the Israelis, to back off their policy of backing Jabhat al-Nusra and their allies, who again are sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City. And then, right now, here, this is the kind of genius comment that keeps me from the real cushy think tank jobs in Washington, D.C. What happens after Assad falls? What happens when they're successful? Every last Alawite and Shiite and Christian is hunted down like a dog by the Islamic State and killed. Where are they going to go? Boy, the Israelis, I guess, are going to have to let all the Palestinians have the right of return now. All the Israelis are terribly concerned about the humanitarian catastrophe in Syria, you see. They're going to let all those Palestinian refugees in the Yarmouk camp come home. To their homes. Yeah, right. They would rather die laughing watching every last baby in Yarmouk starve to death. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.
Red, I thought I had a guest, and I was all lamenting that I had to stop talking about what I was talking about already, but then I realized that Dar ain't coming on for another half an hour. Good deal. So that means then that, I can play this clip I want to play for you. But you know what, before I do, let me tell you this. A friend of the show, take this for what it's worth, says he knows a guy who was on board the Vinson. And he saw helicopters land, and I'm not sure how exactly he knows that bin Laden was there, but he does confirm that, and that there was another Middle Eastern man in civilian clothes who his source was told was an imam there to do the last rites or whatever you call that in Islam. And at least he was under the impression that they did do it from there. At the time on the boat, he says, my source was told the Middle Eastern man in civvies was the imam who would perform the rites. Said they videotaped it, but he didn't see it. Yeah. I'd like to know more from sources on board that ship. It's interesting that Seymour Hersh in the article says, certainly seems to imply that he never made it to the Vinson at all. I think. The body was last seen in the custody of the CIA. And then if the burial had happened, he kind of skips ahead to the burial and doesn't really talk about the landing on the boat and whether anybody saw him at all and that kind of thing. He skips ahead to the burial and says, well, the burial isn't in the ship minutes or whatever they call it. You know, their records, and they would be there. And so that's kind of a thing. So, but then when I interviewed him, he says, no, I didn't say that. I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't say that. Okay, I gotta go. I said, well, here's the part where you said. And he goes, nah, I don't care. You can correct me after I'm off. Bye. You know, he can be an impatient, kind of testy old man. So, whatever. It's all right. But anyway, point being that I suspect that, well, either he screwed up the way he wrote that or maybe the copy editor nailed him. Because I did see, I forget if it was in the Slate interview or somewhere else, where he said, oh, you want to nail me, huh? How about my copy editor insisted that we write Utah instead of Nevada because she says that they're the same thing. You got me. They practice raiding in Nevada, not in Utah. But it wasn't his mistake. It was the copy editor. And I know from the times that, well, Matt Barganier at Antiwar.com, back when he was the editor of Antiwar.com, he was the greatest editor a man could ever have. He never did anything but fix stuff and make it better. But I had a copy editor at, a couple of places where I've just been nothing but frustrated with their, you know, pretended fixes. Changing what I even mean to say. How can you even, come on, man, that's not the same thing anymore. It's frustrating trying to be a writer and have things up to other people. So I don't know if that was his problem or not. Obviously, Hersh knows the difference between Nevada and Utah, but his British fact checker lady didn't. His copy editor at the London Review of Books did not. I guess she thought that Utah was a region in Nevada or something. I don't know. The hell does she know about anything? Got that Palin Southern South Africa thing getting mixed up there. But anyway, so I don't know. Friend of the show says he knows a guy was on the boat, says, yeah, it happened. And so Hersh, by the way, when he was correcting me and saying, I never said that, blah, 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 he did say then that, no, it went to the Vinson. The military had it, or whoever had it, they had it on board that ship, that much is true. So I don't know. Maybe they did just dump his body in the ocean. I really couldn't say. That part seemed to me like, come on, you threw his body in the ocean. And you know what they said? This is the part that made it believable to me, actually, at the time, the slightest bit believable, is they said, well, yeah, you know, if we just gave his body to the Saudis to bury somewhere, we wouldn't want all of his followers to make a shrine out of it. A shrine. you're worried that they're going to make a shrine to Osama bin Laden. Really? Like, that is so damned stupid that only government officials could be certain. Doesn't that sound like something so wrong that only they could truly believe that? Yeah, those bin Ladenites and their shrines. That's all they ever do is go around building shrines all the time. Anyway, here's Joe Biden saying a thing.
What my constant cry was that our biggest problem is our allies. Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, and I have a great relationship with Erdogan, which I just spent a lot of time with. The Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. What were they doing? They were so determined to take down Assad and essentially have a proxy Sunni-Shia war. What did they do? They poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens, thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad, except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and the extremist elements of jihadis coming from other parts of the world. Now, you think I'm exaggerating? Take a look. Where did all of this go? So now what's happening? All of a sudden, everybody's awakened because this outfit called ISIL, which was al-Qaeda in Iraq, which when they were essentially thrown out of Iraq, found open space and territory in eastern Syria, worked with al-Nusra, who we declared a terrorist group early on, and we could not convince our colleagues to stop supplying them. So what happened? Now all of a sudden, I don't want to be too facetious, but they have seen the Lord. Now we have, the president's been able to put together a coalition of our Sunni neighbors, because America can't once again go in to a Muslim nation and be the aggressor. It has to be led by Sunnis to go and attack a Sunni organization. And so what do we have for the first time? Now Saudi Arabia has stopped the funding going in. Saudi Arabia is allowing training on its soil of American forces under Title 10 open training. The Qataris have cut off their support for the most extreme elements of the terrorist organizations. And the Turks, President Erdogan told me, he's an old friend, said, "You were right. We let too many people through. Now they're trying to seal their border."
Oh, it's too bad that wasn't the whole thing, man. I actually have more of that. I should have played my own, instead of the YouTube, my own clip I had. But anyway, that's it. I mean, right there in a nutshell. Another famous Joe Biden gaffe where he just tells you the honest truth and doesn't consider how scandalous this is. "Oh, yeah, no, the Qataris, they stopped, though," he says. "And the Turks, well, they say, yeah, I guess you're right. Maybe we shouldn't have done that." Except here they are bragging about, "Yeah, we helped al-Qaeda take Idlib." 6 months after that Joe Biden clip. Or more. 8, 10 months after that Joe Biden clip. And then, so now, everybody gets it, right? Even new guys get it. Everybody gets it. There's now a new Islamic State in the land that used to be Western Iraq and Eastern Syria, right? Now taking up that space between what's left of Syria and Southern Iraqi Shiistan and Northern Iraqi Kurdistan. And everybody knows that America is on the side of the Kurds, the Shiites, and the Iranians in the East, on the Eastern front of the Islamic State. Still backing the Mujahideen and their allies in the West. And then now when we get back, we're going to talk about just how much worse things could get and those who are determined to make them that much worse as well.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next one is June 13th in Denver. It's just $5 if you sign up now at taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So, yeah, I guess I can't leave out the context that in terms of the presidential election season, which is already on, that there's going to be some fun to be had in a George Carlinian kind of sick, evil way in watching these candidates grapple over what to do with the Middle East, because nobody... well, put it this way. Any Republican who says, hell yeah, we need to put 100,000 troops back in Iraq in order to solve this problem, and anything less than total victory is unacceptable, et cetera, is digging his own grave. The American people, they may not be as anti-war as you and me, but they don't want that again. Tried that, it led to this. We're going to do that again, what's that going to lead to? Hell. Call it quits, man. On the other hand, the right has to call the Democrats pathetic and weak and wimpy and criticize them for not doing enough all the time. And that goes for Rand Paul, too, on the issue of the Islamic State. I think Obama should be doing more against them, he said. But so the thing of it is, what are you going to do then? You gonna send the Marines to Fallujah, and the Army back to Ramadi and Mosul? Is that the plan? You gonna put David Petraeus back in Mosul? And now, so here is Spencer Ackerman reporting for The Guardian. U.S. hawks criticize Obama for fundamentally flawed Iraq strategy. And then, you got that right. But check out what they got wrong. First of all, it's Jack Keane, the former Army Vice Chief of Staff and mentor to Petraeus, as Ackerman correctly identifies him here, and his pathetic little tool, Fat Neck Fred Kagan of the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Kagan's brother, and the pretended author of The Surge, when really it was Jack Keane and his guys that came up with the idea of if James Baker and the official establishment want out of the Iraq War in 2006 by the end of 08, or really, yeah, at least by the end of 08, then what we should do is double down. That'll teach them. Let's surge. And then once we have enough troops in there, an extra, 40,000, 60,000, whatever it was, then we'll create so much peace in Baghdad that the space will be made for democratic political solutions to the problems that vex that country to take hold. And then with all the benchmarks met, then we'll have our wonderful victory. Remember that? And all they succeeded in doing was losing, only getting a hell of a lot more people killed in the process. Fighting a completely worthless and nonsensical war against Muqtada al-Sadr when they were fighting for his faction. The Iraqi National Alliance that he was one-third of at the time was the same government they were fighting for. And, in fact, the reason that they got kicked out was because Maliki's power was dependent on Sadr. And Sadr told Maliki, I'll keep supporting you, but you got to kick the Americans out. You got to really mean it. And the Iranians, were the ones who really brokered that deal. So the surge itself was a total failure. They didn't, it was the secessionists among the Shia that the Iranians and the Americans supported. They wanted Baghdad, but then they didn't really care about ruling Sunni Stan after kicking them all out of the capital city, that is. And help lead to this whole thing. Right? There was no victory. There were no benchmarks met. None. And here are these same two flim-flam artists. The authors of this failure, of David Petraeus' ultimate counterinsurgency surge awakening failure. And they're now saying we got to put more people back in there. Fred Kagan says, testifying before the Senate on Thursday morning, he said we must have a total of at least 15,000 to 20,000 U.S. troops in Iraq in order to provide the necessary enablers, advisors, and so forth. Anything less than that is simply unserious. And now you might remember that Fred Kagan has been way out ahead of anybody else on this. And last summer, he and his wife, I think it was Fred and his wife, Kimberly Kagan, at the Institute for the Study of War. They put out a report saying we must put, 15 to 20,000 troops into Iraq immediately. And yet in their report, and you can Google this up, your very same self, just as well as me, the Kagans said, it is impossible to articulate a clear path to the desired end state. Now, I know I hate the way these people talk too, but one more time in case you were distracted. Tell your friend to shut up. You're trying to listen to this. It is impossible to articulate a clear path to the desired end state. Let's go ahead and put 25,000. That's what it was. They were calling for 25 then. They've dumbed it down to at least 20 now. And the Kagans, the number one proponents of this surge, just like the last one, admit that it is impossible for them to tell you how this is supposed to end. Even what the desired end state is supposed to be. And sure as hell not how to get there from here. But let's put in tens of thousands of American infantry anyway. Enablers, advisors, and so forth. Well, what are they talking about? And, of course, they're ignoring completely, willfully ignoring completely, the aforementioned Muqtada al-Sadr. Key Iraq cleric threatens U.S. over plans to declare Sunnis, Kurds, countries. Sadr says he will reform the Mahdi Army's military wing. He's insisting on Iraqi unity without U.S. interference. And he said before, sorry, I had the wrong story here. He said before anyway, any U.S. forces that he can get near, he'll fight. That the U.S. is absolutely unwelcome to return to Iraq. And he has the ability to enforce that to a great degree. Now, I don't know exactly the power relationships between Iraqi Hezbollah and Asaib al-Haq and the Badr Brigade and the Mahdi Army and those are all Shiite militias. I don't know. His is the Mahdi Army. I don't know exactly how well they get along and this kind of thing. You know, the Badr Brigade, they're much more the Iranian sock puppets, happy with splitting Iraq up. But Sadr has said he'll fight to prevent that from happening. And so our best case that the Kagans could probably make anyway would be that, well, we have to help Sadr conquer Sunnistan. We have to help all these Shiite militias. I mean, they would lie, right, and say, no, we have to just build up a gigantic Iraqi army like the one we just built up that completely fell apart, that they only got 10,000 men left, that only their special forces are anything, and the rest of the entire Iraqi army is nothing. They all went back to their militias. And that's what they would say. But what they want is to fight on the side of Iran and Iran's sock puppet Shiite militias against the Islamic State. That's what they claim they want. At the same time that they're backing the same thing, if not outright backing the Islamic State or al-Nusra, pretty freaking much backing the Islamic State and al-Nusra in Syria. Certainly, they've done everything for years to be even to, I don't know if you call it the right or whatever, but even worse than Obama on regime change against Assad. In other words, in favor of the Caliph Ibrahim. And so, that Barack Obama, he's just not doing enough. Really? He's not doing enough for who? He should be doing more for the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda in Syria, and he should be doing more for Iran and the Badr Brigade and Muqtada al-Sadr against them in Iraq. Oh, man, no need to get specific now. Just pay me. That was what he said. That was reading between the lines of Fred Kagan's shtick. But, yeah, no. You know what they would say, of course, is, no, you're right. You know, Iranian influence, we don't know how it got this way. Mystery for all time. But, yeah, there is too much Iranian influence in Iraq, and that's why we need as many ground troops as we can possibly put in there to limit the influence of every other faction. Because of how well that worked out last time, you see? Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. All right, kiddos. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is Dar Jamail. Writing now at tomdispatch.com. Of course, he's the author of Beyond the Green Zone and The Will to Resist. And we run a hell of a lot of Tom Dispatch stuff under Tom's name at antiwar.com, including this one. Dar Jamail, The Navy's Great Alaskan War. Welcome back, Dar. How you doing, man?
Thanks, Scott. Good to be with you again.
Yeah. Good to talk to you, too, man. And, you know, it's kind of funny. It seems like, and I don't really know, but maybe we've talked about this, but seems like you're really trying to take a break from the wars, man. You've been through a lot reporting on Iraq War II for so many years, and so you've come home and really kind of moved to covering the environment, but it seems like the Pentagon's following you around, dude.
They're following all of us around. That's the problem. There's no escape from the long arm of the U.S. military. It's pretty incredible.
All right, so this one is Destroying What Remains, How the U.S. Navy Plans to War Game the Arctic. In fact, before we get to that, I remember hearing claims anyway back when, based on what I don't know, that, you know, where they were ranking the worst polluters on the planet, and the Pentagon was in first place, and the rest of the U.S. government was in second place, and then after that were, I guess, other nations, the Chinese or the Indians or the Russians or something. But is there any kind of good numbers about that you know of?
I don't have those off the top of my head other than to know the generalities that you just spoke of, the most important one being that people remember that the Pentagon is the single largest user of fossil fuels on the planet and the single largest emitters of CO2 on the planet. Mm.
That may be what I was thinking of, but I guess maybe I was just kind of lumping in, you know, DU and whatever other catastrophes. And, you know, as Kelly Vallejos points out, just pounding the Iraqi desert sand with bombs for 25 years, that drums up a lot of nasty stuff up into the air, a lot of weird heavy metals and, you know, little molecules of things that had been you know, deeply settled and not a threat. That alone is poison in a way.
No, that's exactly right. And I've actually written about that in the past, you know, kind of in the wake of the DU reporting that I've done and the white phosphorus, but really talking about this toxic legacy that the U.S. military leaves everywhere it goes. I mean, what a lot of people don't understand, you know, we're going to be talking about Alaska today. You know, people think, oh, Alaska, the last great frontier. It's this beautiful, vast, pristine land. The military has over 2,600 toxic waste dump sites in Alaska alone. So that gives people an idea.
2,600?
Yeah.
Pardon me, I had a cough anyway, but I also kind of would have spit out my coffee if I had some. I ran out. But, yeah, no, that's incredible. So, now, what kind of toxic waste is that? Is that nuclear waste or just other kinds of poisons?
Anything from, like, old paint in rusting barrels beside rivers to toxic munitions to just garbage. I mean, that has heavy metals in it. I mean, it's, you know, the entire spectrum. I don't think there's anything nuclear. I mean, I could be wrong. I hope I'm not. I don't think there's nuclear waste, but certainly all the kinds of heavy metals and other types of fuels. I mean, for example, in some of the propellants, and I mentioned this in the article that we're going to talk about, in some of the propellants of their missiles, there's literally cyanide. So even the Navy's own environmental impact statements mentions, yeah, when these munitions are used, a certain amount of that propellant that doesn't burn goes into the water. And, you know, there's therefore cyanide being introduced into the food chain. So that gives you an idea. I mean, you know, and we talk about, you know, fuels, just basic gasoline or oil. I mean, people forget that oil is a hazardous material. And when you store old oil in rusting drums out in the middle of nowhere in Alaska, eventually it's going to be introduced back into the environment and the food chain. So that gives people an idea.
Yeah, and, you know, I could kind of imagine a conservative objection that, hey, listen, you know what? We still have to have a military, and they have to train and in order to keep us safe and this and that, except that, of course, all this is training for enforcing world empire. None of this has to do with defending the United States that has no state adversaries on the planet.
Well, that's exactly right, Scott. And, you know, another counter to that argument is, because I've been running into that a lot. I've been writing now. I mean, it's kind of becoming my beat now at least one of my beats is following the domestic military expansion. And I run into that all the time. Like, you know, look, the military has to train, et cetera, et cetera. And I would say, yes, okay, they need to train. I understand that, but they need to follow the law and they need to do so. And if they're going to train, they need to follow their own, you know, really actually follow the NEPA process and really do environmental impact statements and really involve the public in the decision making about what they're going to do, when and how, and, you know, do it above ground and follow the law. Cause literally what they're doing is not following our own domestic law. And theoretically, as you know, here's a good laugh, but theoretically, since, you know, we control the military, if this is in theory a democracy, then they should at the very least be following domestic law with their training, and they're not.
All right. Well, so now be more specific on that point then, as we get into this article here. What exactly do the laws mandate and how severely are they being broken here?
Well, the basics of them are, without getting too into the bureaucratic specifics that would, you know, make people run from their radios or computers listening to this. In sum, there are laws set up in the United States that a bureaucracy that the military has to follow in order to go through a process. Like, for example, here where I live on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State, they have to go through the Forest Service and require permits to do training that they want to do out on the western edge of the Olympic Peninsula. They want to do electromagnetic warfare training there. So they have to contact the Forest Service and go through a specific set of guidelines that the Forest Service has to set up, which means, okay, you have to conduct your own environmental impact statement, make it public, hold public meetings, bring the public into this, give the public the right to comment, ask questions, bring forth any concerns, and then you have to address those. That's just one example. There's several safeguards like that set up that the military has to do. And so instead of doing that, what their plan has been, and I wrote about this in a broader article a ways back about the broader domestic military expansion that's happening, like Jade Helm down in Texas in the Southwest. But writing about how what the military does is they do kind of this faux attempt at following that process. So they have to alert the public. So they'll put a pamphlet up in a post office on a bulletin board. So technically they've alerted the public. And then they'll have their little public meeting, which then nobody comes to because nobody knows about it. And they'll have guys show up and they'll have all their propaganda out on some tables in a public library, for example. And then so they can say, yeah, hey, we informed the public and then here's we're doing our exercise now. Nobody voiced any opposition. So that's just one example of how they circumvent the law and really the democratic public process and bringing people into the fold and doing things the way they're supposed to do it.
Right. Well, and it just goes to overall government contempt for even the theory or even the pretension anymore. I guess the pretension, they'll go with the pretension, but they just really hate the idea that it's supposed to be a rule of law, not men. You know, like it's not enough power to get to administer the law or get to enforce it or act it out, carry it out in whatever way. They got to break it, too. You know, otherwise they're just not happy, never satisfied unless they're going beyond what they're allowed.
Well, the whole point of what I think I know we're jumping ahead of ourselves because we haven't even really talked much about the Navy in Alaska yet. But I think what people need to understand is the military, the way they're behaving at home is they're not running around killing civilians like they did in Iraq. But as far as the total disregard for law, the total disregard for, you know, what the public thinks or is concerned about, whether it be jet noise or environmental impacts or things like this, they don't give a darn. They just don't care. And they're thumbing their nose at people and they're just going ahead and doing their stuff anyway.
Yep. All right. Well, I'm sorry we got to take this break, Dar, but hang tight right there. When we get back, we'll get more specific in the case of the Pentagon's war against the people and property of Alaska. The great state of Alaska. Twice as big as Texas, really?
Two and a half times.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Dar Jamail, author of this great new article at tomdispatch.com, The Navy's Great Alaskan War. And he already said they got 2,600 toxic waste dumps in Alaska. The military does. God knows what other, you know, national government departments are doing in that land. And now, so this article, man, you really get into what's going on here. And I think this ought to be a challenge to conservatives and their opinions about property rights and eminent government ownership of land versus private ownership of land. And I think, you know, conservatives need to ask themselves whether you're all really just a bunch of communists. Or whether you actually believe in private property. But anyway, so, yeah, listen close to what our friend Dar Jamail has to say about what they're doing in Alaska here. Go ahead, Dar.
So basically in about 3 weeks from right now, the military has plans to bring a whole bunch of warships up to the Gulf of Alaska, and they have access to an area. It's an exercise called Northern Edge, and it's basically war gaming in preparation for getting up into the Arctic. Once the Arctic ice starts completely melting out in the summers, which the Navy estimates could be as soon as next year, and the way things are melting out up there, it looks like they could be right that we start seeing ice-free periods of the summer that will just expand over time. And so they're wargaming in the Gulf of Alaska. And so that means this Northern Edge exercise is going to take place over an area of 8,429 nautical miles. So it's a massive area in the middle of the Gulf of Alaska. It contains critical habitat for all five wild Alaskan salmon species, and over 350 other species of marine life. That includes a whole lot of different kinds of whales, at least one of which is highly endangered, the North Pacific right whale, as well as dolphins and sea lions. Bearing in mind that this area is, like I said, with the salmon, it's also happening right smack in the middle of salmon fishing season. And so fishermen in Kodiak and Cordova and a lot of other Southeast Alaskan towns are up in arms about this. And in fact, just last weekend, there were over 170 fisher boats from the port of Cordova that came out and had a flotilla. AP covered it. It got a lot of international coverage. No shocker here. It got almost, you know, no coverage here in the United States outside of up with some of the local media in Alaska. But the Navy's plans also, people are so enraged because they are permitted to use 352,000 pounds of what they call expended materials, a huge percentage of those being live munitions, missiles, bombs, torpedoes. They're going to be using active and passive sonar. Needless to say, that's not going to go have good positive effects on salmon migrating through the area. The Navy's own so-called environmental impact statement estimates 182,000 takes, which is a direct death of a marine mammal or the disruption of essential behaviors like breeding, nursing, or surfacing, which ultimately leads to a death as well. And that's over the 5-year period which their war games are planned on being conducted. So
now stop right there for a second and elaborate, please, if you could. Explain how it is that sonar, what's sonar? What the hell has that got to do with hurting anybody?
Well, for example, I think most people are aware of the fact that whales and dolphin and migrating fish like salmon, they are impacted in the water by sound waves. Their bionavigational abilities are going to be impacted. It confuses them. And so, for example, anytime you see a big stranding of porpoises or whales, whether it's down in New Zealand or down in off the coast, you know, on the coast of Southern California, oftentimes the Navy is to blame because they've been blasting. They have sonar weapons also, and they've been doing sonar testing and sonar weapons testing. And then, oh, if a pod of whales or dolphins just happens to be going by, they get hit and then all their bodies wash up on shore. And so, in fact, the NRDC just earlier this month, a federal court found the Navy guilty for basically causing over 9 million instances of harm of whales and dolphins and other marine life from blasting sonar off the coast of Southern California. So it's well documented that using active and passive sonar has negative impacts on marine biological organisms.
And now, I don't really know enough about this, but I think I remember seeing on the Discovery Channel or some kind of thing, Dar, that what we're talking about here, too, that people need to understand is 21st century sonar, badass sonar. That's an entirely different, level of power and quality than what people are thinking of from old movies or whatever. So it's not just, you know, the boop boop sound or something. They are blasting the brains right out of these animals.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, there are underwater sonar weapons testing ranges, even right up here in Puget Sound, right off the coast where nearby where I live. There's underwater munitions testing, and they have certain areas where the Navy's already permitted to be doing this kind of thing. And exactly the sonar that they're using, I mean, they've weaponized it. It's not like the submarine movies where, you know, there are these little pings and things like this and these little sound waves. We're talking about levels of sound waves that have the ability to literally explode the eardrums of whales and dolphins, and you can easily find photos of that online. It's that's well documented also.
Mm. Right. And again, not to be chalked up as necessary evil, just evil. But anyway, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I wanted, you know, maybe a little bit of explanation there, because I'm not sure if people understand how that works, that a little sonar ping is going to destroy sea populations like that, when in fact you almost couldn't overstate it.
Well, right. And, you know, another aspect of this is I talk with a commercial fisherwoman, and she's also a native woman and a member of one of the tribes in Cordova. And she said, look, put it into perspective. What people don't understand about fisheries is, like, this is how this entire part of that state even exists. Like, without the fishing industry, they're just going to go away. And that includes the native tribes. And so she asked the question that I think puts this in context. She says, you know, would we allow the Navy to bomb farmland? Why are we allowing them to bomb this fishing area? Because it's basically the fisher's equivalent to farmland. Why would we allow them to bomb it and introduce toxic munitions and cyanide and heavy metals into a place where we're trying to get our food, let alone pristine wild-caught salmon?
Hey, what about depleted uranium?
Yeah, that too. You know, so it begs the question, if someone describes themselves as a conservative, what are they conserving?
Right, exactly. And I think that's the whole thing, man, is environmentalism has too much of a kind of Greenpeace sort of a brand name on it or whatever. But you could just as easily sell it as, you know, rifle-toting conservation, as a kind of conservative kind of a thing. Conservatism is supposed to be about preserving the best of what we've got in our society, supposedly, right?
That's true.
Is it just about worshiping the military state? Oh, okay, that's different. All right. Great work, as always. Thanks so much for your time on the show, Dar. Good talk to you.
Thanks for having me, Scott. Take care.
All right. See you next time. All right, that's the great Dar Jamil. He's at tomdispatch.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Okay, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Like in the website, scotthorton.org. I'm live here from noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time, on the Liberty Radio Network at libertyradionetwork.com, LRN.FM. And you can find all the archives and sign up for all the podcast feeds and all that stuff at scotthorton.org. Okay, good. Next up is Brad Hoff of Levant Report, the real Middle East debunking the soundbites. Welcome back to the show, Brad. How are you doing?
Thanks so much for having me back on, Scott.
Good to talk to you again. Your audio now sounds terrible compared to a few minutes ago. Did something change?
Nothing changed. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you sound good now. So we'll go ahead. 2012 Defense Intelligence Agency document. West will facilitate rise of Islamic State in order to isolate the Syrian regime. Now, there's much to talk about in this document and in context. But first, I want to make sure, Brad, that we don't overstate things, or that we try to state things as carefully and accurately as we can here. You're a former Army guy, so I hope that you can explain to me just exactly what this document is. It's labeled secret, but then again, it also says information report, not finally evaluated intelligence, and there's quite a bit blacked out, well, with big white squares, but much of it is redacted. And so I wonder if there's any question as to the context of exactly what document are we looking at here. After all, they gave it, not even a lawsuit, but just a simple FOIA, they gave it to Larry Klayman at Judicial Watch. So before we get into all the substance, I wonder if you can give us your best estimation of exactly what it is we're looking at here.
Well, you're right. That is a question. And currently there's a bit of debate over this document happening online right now. And that is the question, whether how suggestive of policy it is versus how merely predictive it is. I mean, one of the things that the DIA does, along with CIA analysts, well, they sit around and, based on their best research, they make predictions. And so, yes, certainly on one level, this is merely as realist a prediction as possible, but it is fascinating, the predictions made, because they seem to have all come true, especially in the last year as a Islamic State makes itself known and becomes bigger and bigger. But that's certainly a question, whether or not this is an active policy document or whether or not it's mere analysis. I would tend to side on the mere analysis side. The DIA has been actually pretty consistent when other agencies have not been. They actually, back when President Bush was making the case to invade Iraq, they actually gave some pretty spot-on intelligence about the infamous aluminum tubes. And there was a DIA document that said Saddam was merely seeking those tubes to make mortars, conventional weapons, but apparently that was suppressed by the Bush administration. And so, no, I would say that much of this document is merely predictive, but it's as realistic as possible, and it proved spot on.
All right, now, so we got plenty of time for the context here, but for the content. But as far as the context, can you say, is it certain whose voice that's in, this is in? They're not saying, well, this is what a guy told us or something like that. This is one a DIA employee reporting to his boss what he best thinks. Is that it?
Well, I don't know. I've actually personally never been an analyst, though I've worked on the peripheries of intelligence circles when I was at Quantico and in the Pentagon briefly. I do still have a number of friends that are active in the intelligence world, especially CIA. And documents like this tend to start at lower levels, and then they get kicked up the chain. But if you look at the first page of this document, it was actually pretty widely circulated. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at, I think, what is a reference to the Joint Chiefs, Department of Homeland Security, State Department, CIA. It was sent to the Navy Yard. It was sent around to multiple Air Force generals. So it looked like a widely circulated document. But at the same time, it notes that it is an information report, not finally evaluated intelligence. But it was clearly part of the high-level conversation.
Yeah, and it's certainly accurate enough. And, boy, I sure would like to see an unredacted piece of this when you see what they allowed you to go ahead and read in here. Really makes me wonder. And that some of these redactions are really big. A whole page, in fact, is missing here. But so, all right, so it's some kind of DIA report. It doesn't seem like they're just saying, hey, boss, this is what an informant told us or anything like that. It does seem to be the opinion of the view or the assessment of the person writing it, as best as I can tell just from reading it. But I don't have any familiarity really with Army documents or exactly how these things work. But that's the way it seems like. And then, so now... Oh, we still got time for this segment, thank goodness. Let's break it down. I mean, start at the beginning, the first important part you think that we need to take a look at here or go from just order of importance. What is it that is such a big deal about this thing?
Well, as I was going through the documents on Judicial Watch, and to my knowledge, Judicial Watch, they only published, I think, a selection of the 100 documents that were made available after the court-ordered declassification based on multiple denials of their FOIA requests. But as I was looking through these, I was pretty surprised at the admissions, like you say, but equally surprised, or maybe I shouldn't be surprised, that Fox's initial coverage, for example, just focused on the Benghazi angle. It seems like few people bothered to really dig into this particular August 12, 2012 document. And so when I first started reading it, I had the same really shock or surprise as you did, starting from the general situation, the kind of broad summary. It says, internally, events are taking a clear sectarian direction. The Salafists, the Muslim Brotherhood, and AQI are the major forces driving the insurgency in Syria. But then it follows that up with note C, the West, Gulf countries, and Turkey support the opposition. Again, opposition was previously defined as Salafist and Muslim Brotherhood. And this is actually consistent
and Al-Qaeda.
With...
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
And it's exactly. Interesting the way they do that, too, right? It's just like on TV, where they go, oh, yeah, the rebels in Syria, they're the Bin Ladenites. And then they turn right around and they go, so what are we going to do about this Assad guy? And they just, you know, pretend the dissonance in there. They just skip right over it. And it's the same kind of thing here. We're like, yes, we support the opposition. The opposition are our enemies.
Well, it's not the first time. It's not the first time. I saw a good article that... called the current Syria proxy war Afghanistan 2.0. I mean, this is how policy is created. You know, the whole idea of my enemy's enemy is my friend, and, well, we saw the blowback from the so-called Afghan freedom fighters on 9/11. I fear even worse blowback from our current policies in Syria. But... it not only identifies the opposition, the document not only identifies the opposition as Al-Qaeda, it actually very matter-of-factly states that the external powers are supporting this Al-Qaeda opposition.
Right, and include themselves in it. All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back with Brad Hoff from LevantReport.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Brad Hoff, former U.S. Army. Fortunately, didn't have to kill anybody in the war or anything. Then he went to live in Syria for a little while until America and its allies started backing the Mujahideen. And now, you know, the shock here when we're talking about this document... LevantReport.com is where he writes, LevantReport.com. The shocking thing here is just that they would... write so frankly about what it is that they're up to. Obviously, they knew as well as all of us did that this was their plan. It was the Prince Bandar helped arrange this thing from the very beginning in 2011. The Americans and their NATO allies, especially the French, were in on it from the beginning. And, they succeeded in getting a lot of people killed. I guess they thought it would be easy like Libya. But, you know, I have these two clips, and I like to play them, and so here I'm going to, again, real quick here. First of all, I should say, this is Hillary Clinton from February or March, early March, maybe, in 2012, when she's on the defensive. Why aren't we doing enough to overthrow Assad in Syria? And she's explaining the Obama regime's lack of action. This is when, of course, she's still the Secretary of State here. And so her excuse for not doing more is...
we know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria?
And then this is, again, CBS News. I think I said that. CBS News. And then she further elaborates that...
so I think Wyatt, you know... despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a Secretary of State and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable, we don't see that.
There it is. That's the ultimate concession right there. Obama himself said the idea we're going to support an army of moderates to take on all jihadists and the Assad army backed by Iran and Hezbollah and Russia. That was always a fantasy, just like Scott Horton always said since 2011 on. That's a direct quote, I'm pretty sure. No, not the last part. So that brings us back to this document here where it's just proof, really, solid proof that at some very high level inside the government, they were being very frank about what they were doing there. The opposition is the enemy. We're supporting the opposition. And then, so go ahead and tell us, Brad, what do they predict to be the result of their support for our enemies, especially the al-Nusra Front, which is just al-Qaeda in Syria, sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City.
Exactly right. Let me just go ahead and read from the document. It says, there is the possibility of establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist principality in eastern Syria, and this is exactly what the supporting powers to the opposition want, in order to isolate the Syrian regime. And of course, Salafis, a lot of times it's used interchangeably with the term Wahhabi. These are the radical, militant Sunnis that believe in a literal expression of jihad. But it says it right there, and it was hard to report on this document because, of course, in 2012, there was no such thing as the Islamic State as it exists as a proper noun or proper name today. But the term Islamic State shows up multiple times throughout the article. It does specifically refer to, I believe, Islamic State in Iraq and references AQI, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, a lot. And it seems to assume that that nascent Islamic State would be rooted in Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is exactly what happened. Back in 2012, well, this is before ISIL or ISIS was a household name that everyone knew about. The incarnation of ISIS or Al-Qaeda as it was then was, of course, as you said, al-Nusra. But ISIS became more of a distinct reality when it broke away from traditional Al-Qaeda in, I believe, 2013. But, of course, at that time, they were all working together along with the Free Syrian Army. As I've written before, the Free Syrian Army itself was but a kind of branding construct, a way to sell the rebels to the West. If you remember the PLO under Arafat, what you had with Arafat was a visible face, but the PLO was always just a kind of umbrella group. I'm not trying to say these groups are synonymous at all in their ideology. I'm just trying to reference the way that it's structured. So the PLO was never this unified reality. It was a command structure with Arafat as the face, a kind of umbrella group, right? Umbrella group. As I tend to explain it to people. And so the FSA itself was never a unified reality in the same way. FSA was just a kind of command structure that was over many, many, many factions. And I'm not at all trying to say that the PLO and the FSA are at all the same in their ideology. PLO is always more leftist. But just in terms of structure, FSA was never a unified reality. And so what that meant was you had commanders such as, this Colonel Okaidi, who was head of the Supreme Military Council of Aleppo, exercising direct command over al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda in Syria, as well as ISIS. And this is proven with multiple reports and even video footage from the Battle of Meneg Air Base in the summer of 2013. So these groups were working together all along, and yes, later on, they started fighting each other as the opposition splintered, but they go in and out of union with each other.
Yeah, well, and it was clear, and it's just kind of my luck that I've just been doing this show so long and interviewing all these great reporters just kind of all along that whatever the issue is, we were covering it correctly at the time because it was Patrick Coburn who was doing the commenting, that kind of thing. And the likes of David Anders, I always like to bring up David Anders, writing then for McClatchy Newspapers, would say that, hey, the field is dominated by the al-Nusra Front. And I would ask him, because he was experienced in Iraq War II, and I would ask him, well, in Iraq War II, the jihadists were the smallest part of the Sunni insurgency, allowed to help fight when they got too big for their britches and more harm than they were worth, more trouble than they were worth. The local Sunni tribesmen turned on them and kicked their ass, and Petraeus took the credit, but that's not what happened, kind of thing. And you know, he knew all that because he had covered it in real time. And so I would ask him to compare that, and he would say, oh, yeah, no, but in Syria it's different. In Syria, the war is the al-Nusra Front, basically. The FSA guys are, you know, more or less standing around getting paid.
Yes, exactly. And so, as I said, you find the term Islamic State throughout the document. And yes, you're right. At that time, it was al-Nusra Front. Ironically, we now have a very literal Islamic State. which has taken over much of Iraq and half of the geographic territory of Syria. But in terms of admissions...
Well, they say that, too. They say this thing is sure to blow back into Iraq. That's the danger, and they correctly call it a danger, not the plan, you know. But, you know, they basically fully expect it to, even they say, to grab Mosul and Ramadi. Oh, man.
No, the DIA was right on in this document. Everyone should read it. I'm trying to spread it far and wide. In fact, I called DIA Public Affairs this morning to ask them for some context, and they're supposed to get back to me possibly through an email, but maybe not at all. I called CIA Public Affairs as well, and I'm trying to get some maybe a quote or some information from them. But in terms of high-level confessions, let me give you one that hasn't seen a lot of circulation. We talked about Ambassador to Syria Robert Ford last time, and I referenced the Minig air base, which was taken from the government by the rebels in summer of 2013. It's well known that Ambassador Ford, had a direct relationship with the Free Syrian Army Colonel Okaidi, who led that assault. And there were NPR articles and AP and Reuters reports and things like this, all confirming that Ambassador Ford was working with the Supreme Military Council at the time. The United States was likely paying the salaries of the commanders. And of course, last time we talked, we also talked about Ambassador Robert Ford's incredibly candid admissions now, that saying, well, really, there never were moderates. But a lot of people have never seen what his interaction with some Middle East journalists on his Twitter account. His Twitter account is @FordRS58. And his admissions on his Twitter account were so shocking, I actually tried to get some independent verification that this is indeed Ambassador Robert Ford's Twitter account. A number of internationally known Syria analysts follow this account, but I just wanted to make sure, so I contacted Joshua Landis, of the University of Oklahoma. He's the director of Middle East Studies there. He also runs the website Syria Comment. He's widely regarded as an expert on Syria. He confirmed to me that this is Robert Ford's account. And on February 23rd of this year, an Al Monitor journalist, who I believe is embedded in Aleppo, he writes under the pseudonym Edward Dark. He asks Robert Ford on Twitter, "Do you deny knowing that most of the moderates you directly backed fought alongside ISIS and al-Nusra on front lines in Aleppo in 2013? And this is Robert Ford's response. "Absolutely do not deny. Criticized them in 2013 and 2014 and publicly a month ago. Major problem for opposition." And, of course, McClatchy also recorded Ambassador Ford as more recently saying, "The days of looking the other way while..." You know, the context was weapons going to al-Nusra. The days of looking the other way are over. So there's all kinds of high-level admissions, and this DIA document really completes the picture, I would say.
Mm. Now, you know, Obama, and we're going over time here. Is it all right? You got a minute?
Sure.
Okay, cool. So Obama told Jeffrey Goldberg back in 2012, "Yeah, you're right, Jeffrey Goldberg. Getting rid of Assad and replacing him with a solid democratic opposition, that would be a great way to take Iran down a peg. And, you know, oh, and I can't tell you all that we're doing because then I'd have to kill you," kind of thing. Ha ha ha. He didn't use the "then I'd have to kill you," but he does joke about it's classified. "I can't tell you everything, but trust me, Jeffrey Goldberg, we're working really hard on it." And, so that lays bare the motive, I guess, as far as the Americans are concerned. And I guess, you know, the Turks and the Saudis have their own motives for wanting to, you know, hurt Assad. But then presumably, and I don't know about the Turks, but presumably the Americans, the Israelis, and the Saudis have an interest in trying to weaken Iran, even though the Americans stupidly gave them the southern, you know, half of Iraq, basically, the southeastern part of Iraq there. But then it seems like, here's the point I'm finally getting to, creating the Islamic State and allowing the rise of the Islamic State, as so accurately predicted in this document that we're talking about here, seems like maybe it is a good way to hurt Assad and take half of his country away from him. I'll buy that. But in Iraq, all they've done is basically provoke the Iranians into having given them an excuse to double or triple or whatever number their support and integration with the Iraqi government, the Baghdad government, which is, after all, still just the Dawa party basically running the thing. And, you know, whatever differences there were between the Iranians and the Shiite government in Baghdad, this crisis has helped surely to paper those over. We've seen the head of the Quds force leading the militias on the ground. Of course, they're arming them and training them and paying them, the Shiite militias that are fighting. And so this seems like, if anything, has helped the Iranians solidify their gains from Iraq War II rather than worked in any way to limit them. I mean, sure, it's helped divide Assad from them, but hell, if you give them twice the Baghdad they have before, who cares?
Our alliances currently in the Middle East are becoming so contradictory so fast. I sometimes can barely keep up, as I think is the case with many Americans. What I do know, knowing a lot of Syrians, knowing Iraqis, none of this helps the common people, right, which is what the political class always claims. And so it really sickens me that, to reference the title of Brzezinski's famous book, The Grand Chessboard, it really sickens me that the political class in Washington just sits around and manipulates the region like it's a chessboard. And yes, ISIS is a strategic tool, as you said, to put pressure on the Syrian regime, put pressure ultimately on the Iranians, perhaps used to bring them to the table. I'm not sure if there's evidence that the United States is actively seeking to overthrow the Syrian government, but clearly, Washington did want the fragmentation of Syria, and clearly Washington did want to use ISIS and these other radical groups to paint the Syrian government in a corner. And sadly, nobody wins, no matter if a common civilian on the ground identifies with the opposition or the government or somewhere in the middle. Nobody wins. And so it's just it's really a sad state of affairs, especially for people who know people on the ground. It seems increasingly obvious that those in power, those making the decisions, do not actually know people affected by these decisions.
Yeah. Well, and if they know what they're doing, then God help them. You know what I mean? Their best argument is that they're the stupidest people on the face of the earth who ever held power. But if they don't have that going for them, then may God have mercy on their souls for this madness. I mean, we're only stage two of this, you know, certain to be a century long sectarian civil war over there in the Middle East that George W. Bush started. And Obama has just, he made sure, right? He's the guy who dropped the cinder block on the gas pedal and jumped out.
No doubt. This is a theater war. This is a theater war. And, you know, Syria and Iraq, it kind of comes in and out of the media, but Americans need to realize this is a theater war that has the potential at any moment to blow up in a fully acknowledged world war. Absolutely.
All right, y'all, that's Brad Hoff. He's writing at LevantReport.com. This one is called 2012 DIA Document, West Will Facilitate Rise of Islamic State in order to isolate the Syrian regime. Read it and weep. Thanks, Brad.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, y'all. Thanks. See you tomorrow. I mean, Monday.